Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
Yeah. Yes, that's that's completely true. Yes, it is. Okay. Good one, Reggie. Very good.
All right. You are on your game today. Hopefully I will too. I will be too. I'm already not, right? All right, let's go. I see those oh my God. Okay. Come on. Get sharp here. I see those needles bopping. So that's in a good place. Wow. Okay. Let's go. Come on. I'm going to do my three S's today. I don't know. I'm just a little giddy today. Okay. We ready? Here we go. I like where those needles are bouncing. So keep them there, Reggie. I'll give you the three S's. I'll give you the countdown. You give me the music, and I will give you one hell of a podcast. Starting good already, right? Yeah, okay. Thankfully, this is just the preliminary stuff. No one really hears this. All right? Okay, here we go. Okay, Jim, focus now. Focus, focus, focus. Star, smile, strong. All right, here we go. Put it in the books, by the way, Reggie. Episode 245. You ready? Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com, or we are found wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. It only stands to reason. We should be, and we are there. As you know, you have many responsibilities as a listener to this podcast. One is certainly to listen. Thank you very much for that. But, this is a proactive podcast. We got to get you guys busy, get you guys out there. So spread the word. Send a link, send a message, tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody you know that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And why the heck isn't it there? Your loyalty, devotion, and that little extra credit effort is much appreciated and will be rewarded sometime in the future. Just don't wait too long. Also, if you like what you hear, don't forget you go to WGNradio.com and you go to the podcast section and you hit the prompt for this podcast and you can find all previous 244 episodes, which can only mean one thing. You are in the midst of episode 245. So what I wanted to talk about today, pretty major news events since we last spoke. I do record this podcast before it is aired. It's not live, and sometimes it's a little earlier than others. And so I was not able... When I recorded this one, the inauguration hadn't happened yet. The presentation, the program, the actual ceremony, as well as some of the special presentations after the inauguration. And so, one thing that I did want to point out, which I pointed out earlier in a previous podcast when I talked about Bruce Springsteen appearing on Saturday Night Live, and I was just kind of aghast and almost horrified and really couldn't enjoy the performance and felt that it was a little hypocritical for Bruce to appear on this national television televised show in a, yes, tested and controlled environment, yet still a public environment on a very small stage where I don't care how good the tests are. You never know. Unless you live with those people, you don't know where they are and where they've been and what they've been doing. And all it takes is 1 second of letting your guard down. And so I just felt like that seemed to be a very unsafe kind of environment to perform live. And if you wanted to perform live, and Bruce Springsteen certainly wanted to do that, clearly, to promote his new album, what a statement it would have made to have worn, have him and his entire band, which was at least 8 to 10 people on a very cramped stage, what a message it would have sent. And this was, pre-inauguration, post-election, pre-inauguration. What a message you would have sent about the situation we're in and the importance to wear a mask if he and the entire band would have performed wearing masks. I think it would have made quite a statement, and really would have been more in keeping with Bruce Springsteen's very public condemnation of Donald Trump, and especially his harsh criticism of Trump's anti-mask stand. Right. So, how great of an image and a statement would that have been to come out on national television and perform adapting to the situation rather than almost acting as if it didn't exist? Even though, yes, I know behind the scenes there was a lot of testing. I get it. And from what we understand, or what we've learned, nobody during that broadcast came down with COVID. Maybe they did, maybe we didn't. We don't know. Maybe they'll never even say. I don't know. That's conspiratorial, so I won't bring that up in any serious way. But once again, as far as we know, no one had or caught or came down with the COVID virus after that December performance. So, okay, great. But the risk was certainly there, and it was a big risk. So now I'm watching the inauguration. And there was an interesting mix. While, President Biden is certainly, pushing for a mandate for masks and wearing a mask and making that a high priority, which I think has always should have been, regardless of your political stand, it's just good common sense, and it's good science, and it's good precaution. I don't know how that got politicized, but it did, and that's why we've got, almost 500,000 people who have passed away from COVID during almost a year now. So that's pretty scary. I saw an interesting statistic. United States of America has 4% of the world's population. And thus far, about 2 million people around the world have died from COVID-19-associated complications. Right. So 2 million people around the world have passed away from this pandemic over the last almost a year now. And the United States, while we certainly carry a big stick and a big influence on the world, population wise, we really don't. We have 4% of the world's population, 330 million or so out of what, 7 or 8 billion. So we don't really carry big numbers, but we certainly carry big influence, right? So if you translate those numbers of the 2 million that have died from COVID, if you were to simply relegate the percentage of your population to that number of deaths, the United States, which this is not a, is not something to brag about, but this is a terrible pandemic any way you look at it. But if you were to translate that, the 4% of our population, of that 2 million, we should have about 80,000 deaths at this point of that 2 million around the world, based on our 4%, our 330 million. People, we should have 80,000 deaths. Certainly, 80,000 too many, correct? But we have over 400,000 and growing. we'll be at a half million in no time at all. So that just goes to show you how poorly we have, as a country, have handled the COVID situation, governmental-wise, but more than that, personally. This is not about governments and presidents and whatever. You know, you could use public figures as either scapegoats or excuses, but at the end of the day, it's about personal responsibility. We all know what we should be doing. We all know what is at least helps. It doesn't completely guarantee that you won't get it, but it certainly cuts down the odds of wearing a mask, of social distancing, of not gathering indoors in big numbers, washing your hands. We know this now. A year ago in April or May, some people could have pleaded ignorance, but you can't plead ignorance now. It's too much. It's too long. And it's just about, to me, it's not about political figures or political ideologies. It's about personal responsibility. And we, as a country, sadly, have failed. When in the past, we as a country have always stepped up in times of crisis, during wars and during other kinds of tragedies or calamities, whether they are weather-related, whether they were terrorist-related, we have always come to the aid of our fellow citizens in times of tragedy. And for some reason, I don't know what's happened to us. And I really blame social media more than anything else, because it has given a format and a forum for misinformation and conspiracy theories and niche political views to take on validation with people. And we have forgotten to care about each other. So that's very disappointing. How do I bring this back to what I was talking about? As I told you, just stay with me on the path. I will take many detours during a podcast, but trust me, I will find my way back to the path. And my path was talking about Bruce Springsteen and the inauguration specifically. And so I'm watching the inauguration special. I think it was called Celebrating America. It was on all three networks and several cable stations and PBS. It was all carried live. It was hosted by America's Voice, apparently, America's most favorite citizen now, Tom Hanks. He has taken on the role of Jimmy Stewart, or Walter Cronkite is the most trusted person in America. Clearly, Tom Hanks is that guy. Not sure how it happened. I guess he is just with time and with making popular movies that people have just liked over the last 30 years, that he has grown into that role. But he is now he is more respect probably than our presidents do. So I said Jimmy Stewart kind of had that kind of moniker, and certainly Walter Cronkite did as an anchorman for 30 years or so on television, delivering the news to America. But Tom Hanks is certainly, if he's not the most trusted man in America, he's certainly a member of the club. So he hosted it, and there were several high-profile celebrities who, now, 4 years later, have all been sitting in the weeds. They've been, they haven't really been, they've certainly been critical of Donald Trump, but they certainly haven't been able to come out and perform in support of a candidate that they liked like this. And so, wow, I mean, if you remember 4 years ago at President Trump's inauguration, he could barely get Scott Baio, and within hours of over 4 years, hardly anyone really from the entertainment world came forward and would appear at any of his functions, or would really come out. Even if they were his supporter, they stayed back. And yet for President Biden, my goodness, you know, he took the oath around actually before noon, which I found interesting. They always talk about, well, you know, at noon on January 20th, we get a new president. I looked at my clock, and President Biden took the oath at about 7 or 8 minutes early. So maybe that's a good sign. You know, he's punctual. In fact, what I like, I always like to be at a place before I'm supposed to be there. I'm always punctual, and I'm always early. So I like the fact, political ideologies aside, at least what I liked from minute one, literally, was that he was ahead of schedule. We don't really see that quite anymore with any kind of event or public kind of presentation or celebration. It's always delayed. You know, the press conference was supposed to be at this time. It's delayed. It's still, everything's delayed. So I was actually impressed that he took the oath before noon on January 20th. So if that's any harbinger, hopefully that's a good sign. At the very least, I don't know how he's going to do as a president. We never know. But at least the first minute of his presidency, he was already ahead of schedule. So that's pretty cool. But anyway, within like 7 hours, 7.5 hours of after him becoming president, taking the oath, wow, the heavy hitters of the entertainment world came out of the woods, came out of the weeds where they'd been either hiding or just in hibernation. But wow, they came out in full force to support the new administration. Tom Hanks hosting, Bruce Springsteen, John Bon Jovi, Katy Perry, John Legend. All these folks came out of, wow, they were way off for the last 4 years. They were not around in the political scene, but they couldn't wait. A lot of pent-up energy. So it was a very well-produced show. It looks like it was very cold that day in Washington. A great fireworks display at the end with Katy Perry. Very impressed. I liked John Bon Jovi's song, Here Comes the Sun. Performed it out on a pier somewhere. Not sure where he was. I think it said Miami, Florida. I don't know if it was computer-generated effects or not. But it, regardless, whether it was really good timing or not, these days you can never tell what's going on, what's real or not with the computer technology we have when we watch a film or anything else. It's almost seamless. And so I'm not sure if it was legit or not, whether it was natural or not, but Bon Jovi did a version of the Beatles, George Harrison's Here Comes the Sun. And at the beginning of the song, it was cloudy and dark. It almost looked like it was just before dawn or just before dusk. No, dawn, right, just before the sunset, the sunrise. And, right, dusk is later, right? Get those right. Dawn, beginning of the day, dusk at the end. You know, it's interesting. So women's names are Dawn. And I never really thought of that now. Well, here we go. I'm off the path. Don't worry. I'll get back. So interesting. And I know a few Dawns. That's a nice name. So Dawn, I never really thought about the implications of the name Dawn. What a nice name, actually. You're naming your daughter after the beginning of a new day, of a sunrise. That's really a nice image. I never really thought of that. I don't know if I thought about the Dawn detergent first. but no, wow, that's I have suddenly a new appreciation for the name Dawn. Nice. What's interesting is I don't hear anybody, male or female, named Dusk. See, if I had a kid, I'd name him Dusk. Dusk Toronto. Just to be different. He'd probably change his name and hate me, and that's one reason why I didn't have kids. But we have a Dawn, sunrise, optimism, beauty, right? We don't have dusk. I like a good sunset. I really do. I don't know if it has negative connotations, but I think sunset in many ways is much prettier and is even much more calming than sunrise, because it's at the end of the day and we've finished another day. So it's kind of like a sense of accomplishment, an exhale after these last, 12, 13, 14 hours, whatever it's been, and now we're done and we can relax. And sunsets are gorgeous. When my wife and I went to Lake Tahoe back in October, it was a ritual for us. Every night we would go to the beach and just, they have chairs out there on the beach, and we would just sit there and wait for the sunset. And people it wasn't just us. That was a regular attraction, and it was free. Couldn't beat the price. It was nature show, but there was a certain sense of calm and serenity and completion. We would also get up early in the morning and watch the sunrise. But there's a whole different connotation there. It's the beginning of the day. It's almost like, okay, the sun's up now. Get busy. Let's go. No lollygagging. Whereas when the sun sets, you can lean back in your chair. Sunrise, you got to lean forward. Let's get going. Beginning of the day. Things to do. You're burning daylight. Let's go. Sunset, a little more calming, a little more peaceful, a little more somber and serene. Lean back in that chair. Be grateful for making it through another day, and just kick back and relax. So I love a sunrise, certainly, as you wait for that first peak of sun, the dawn, if you will. But I also like a beautiful sunset as well, and all the feelings and emotions that are tied to it. So yeah, I would have named, and it's a tough sounding name too, right? A little rugged, Dusk. One syllable. I always like one syllable names. I think that is a good thing. There's very little chance for a nickname if you give somebody a one syllable name. It's hard to break it into one or two or a different name. If you notice, most people that have a one syllable name don't get a nickname. Because there's nothing, you really can't, you can't shorten it. It's boom, it's to the point. There's no syllables to break up. So Dusk is one of those. It's kind of a rugged name, kind of a cool name. You don't hear it ever. Wow, where are we? Well, I don't know. I missed my chance. I could have named my kid Dusk Toronto. D-U-S-K, Dusk. Ladies and gentlemen, Dusk Toronto. A boy named Dusk instead of a boy named Sue. But anyway, yeah, so wow, I never really thought about that. The whole idea of the name Dawn is a very hopeful, optimistic name. It's the sunrise. It's the beginning of a day. So anyway, the Jon Bon Jovi version seemed like it started at dawn when it was dark, right before the sunrise, on this pier out in some body of water somewhere in Florida, in Miami, I guess. And then as the song continued to go on, it got brighter as the song talks about in its lyrics. And then for the very ending, the coda, sun, 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 here it comes. And then the sun was bright. Little darling, I could see the ice is slowly melting. And, and then there was a bright sun and the sky was lit up with beautiful, orange and pink and blue sky and clouds. And then they all turned and looked at the illuminated sun at the end of the song. It was very powerful. And certainly had a lot of different connotations and statements to make. But just as visually, I thought it was a great job. I don't know if it was, as I said before, computer generated or not. I don't know if they got up. They, you know, it had to be really good timing if it was natural. They had to find out exactly what time sunrise was supposed to be, time the song, and then say, okay, for, you know, it's supposed to be sunrise at this time, or maybe they had someone go the day before, see what time the sun was in a perfect position, say, okay, it was at, you know, it was at 6:42 when that is the view we had. Okay, that's the view we want when we say, sun, 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 here it comes. Our song is 4 minutes long, so let's start it at this time. I mean, I don't know. Or they could say to a computer guy, as we sing the song, can you make the sky light up with the sun? Might be a little easier to do that. Not sure how it was done, but the finished product was pretty impressive. So nice job, John Bon Jovi. John Legend gave his usual inspiring kind of performance. Great, great voice for John Legend. As I said, Katy Perry ended the show singing her song Fireworks with an amazing, and I'm not even a fireworks guy. I'm really not. In person or on television. On TV, it's hard to be impressed by it. You don't really get the sound and the feel and that bass feeling in your chest when those things explode. I think that's part of the excitement of fireworks. But I'm not all that interested. I mean, for the first couple of explosions, it's interesting. But then, let's be honest, even if you're a fireworks professional, right? It's kind of the same explosion over and over again, right? Just with some different colors, but so I'm not a real big fireworks guy, but wow, it was hard to not be just awed by that. They pulled out all the stops. I think the, you know, they've called off a lot of fireworks displays over the last year, especially on 4th of July, so there must have been a huge stockpile. We don't have a lot of vaccine stockpiled, but why, my gosh, did we have a lot of fireworks, obviously, stockpiled that must have been meeting their expiration date. And they sent them all to Washington, D.C. on January 20th because, my gosh, during Katy Perry's song, it was either a fireworks display or the end of the world. I'm not sure which one, but you had to just go, wow, when you saw that, whether you liked them or not. I mean fireworks. But to get back to my initial point, yes, Reggie, I you don't have to put up a sign that says remember Bruce. I understand. Believe me, it's all cataloged. To get back to my original point here, so well, I was disappointed that Bruce didn't wear a mask back in December when he was on Saturday Night Live. He came out in a very moving and poignant setting right outside the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in the evening. If you've never been to Washington, D.C., or if you have been, you know. If you have been, you know what just a moving, moving, ethereal experience it is to stand outside right in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. at night. It's awe-inspiring. It really is. And so here's Bruce Springsteen as the first performer on the Celebrating America Joe Biden inauguration special that's being seen all around the country, live on several TV, on the major networks as well as on several cable news stations and other entertainment stations. So it's getting some major exposure. And so it's lit. He's lit, you know, from underneath on this solitary platform. So once again, you know, very poignant, very dramatic. And, you know, he chooses a very appropriate song of his, maybe not as well known to many people. It's one of my favorite Bruce Springsteen songs. I'm a Bruce Springsteen fan. He first introduced that song back in 1999 when he got back together with the E Street Band on their reunion tour. And it was the first new song he had written for the band in many years because they hadn't been together. It's a song called Land of Hope and Dreams, so that was certainly an appropriate song title, and the theme of the song, and the song's lyrics certainly play to redemption, rebirth, reaffirmation, freedom. So very big, you know, patriotic themes in that song regardless, but certainly appropriate for the time he was singing it there in the first hours of a new presidential administration. But I was once again, I know, visually and performance-wise, you know, this may have detracted from the quality of the performance and the, but in terms of the statement that could have been made and the presentation, the strength of the message, especially someone like Bruce Springsteen, who, as I said, for the last 4 years has been hypercritical of the former administration. So here he is celebrating this new one, and a major theme and tenet of the Biden presidency is about defeating COVID and getting past the pandemic, and a key strategic initiative in that strategy is wearing a mask. So once again, now on even a bigger stage, yes, you know, Saturday Night Live back in December has a very big audience, but this was a national audience on you know, millions of people literally watching this on a variety of stations, on television, obviously online as well. So the potential had to be tens of millions of people, if not hundreds of millions. I don't know what the ratings were, what the actual viewing was on that special, but potentially tens, 50 million easily, right? I mean, I don't know. What do they say? The Super Bowl has like 100 million people watching it maybe at some time, at least some years. This year will probably be a very good one with Tampa Bay and Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City and Tampa Bay and Tom Brady. That's going to be a pretty good, I'm sure, ratings and audience attractor. But so here was this moment. You can't have much more drama. You can't have much more of a platform to make a statement. And so I really was disappointed once again. I thought he gave a very good, heartfelt performance, and chose the right song to do it. So I was very impressed with his performance, but I still was disappointed that he didn't either think of this, or no one else thought of this around him, or that he was offered this option and maybe rejected it. But if Bruce Springsteen would have been singing on inauguration night in on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, this song of moving forward and hopes and optimisms and dreams, political ideologies aside, whenever a new administration comes in, there's always a sense of optimism and an excitement and hope for the next at least 4 years. And so it was all there. And now we have this added layer of a message that can help, you know, talk about unification, which is all that Joe Biden talked about. Here's a chance to unify and send a message about the importance of sacrifice and adapting for the time being and giving of yourself for others by wearing this mask. It's a major, major theme that Joe Biden is going to be repeating and reinforcing, at least for the next several months, if not this whole year. I think 2021, no one wants to say it because we're at the beginning, but this is going to be a long, long slog, folks. I hope you're ready for it. I hope you don't think that in 3 or 4 months this pandemic is gone, because it's not going to be. The vaccine
is going to take a long time to get distributed. It's going to take a long time to get into people's arms. And hopefully by this time next year, February of 2021, we could be looking to the spring of 2022, a year from now, and say, maybe we're done. That's what I'm expecting. And that's not being negative. It's just being very realistic, seeing how we are handling this today, how we have handled it for the last year, and what we're seeing in terms of the controversy and the slow rollout of this vaccine, and then this variant strain now. There's a lot of new and difficult aspects of this pandemic. It is very trendy to act as if we're in the last throes of this. But to stave off any major depression, you need to start getting into your own minds now that we still got a ways to go. There's certainly hope and optimism, but it's still a long ways away. So I think mask wearing is going to be around with us not only throughout 2021, but even into 2022. And I even believe that for a while, even when we get the all clear, I'm going to be wearing a mask when I go out in public. If I'm doing my errands, certainly in a grocery store or in big public places, maybe, you know, hopefully, you know, I mean, to wear a mask in a restaurant really defeats the purpose. And so hopefully we'll get to a point where we won't have to do that anymore. And I probably wouldn't do that. But when, in terms of going to a store or an airport or some place where there's just a lot of people around initially, even after we get the all clear that it's safe now and everybody's got their shot, whatever kind of, you know, utopia that we're imagining, I still think I'm going to wear my mask. It's I'm used to it now. And so to me, it would have made an amazing statement. It would have been the photo. It would have been the image of the pandemic, not just now, not just in the last week or so, but it would have been a photo for the ages that in the midst of this pandemic, here is this very well-respected, popular, looked-up-to performer, artist, Bruce Springsteen, on the steps of the Capitol, or on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and in the midst of this pandemic, yes, It would be okay. He was by himself. He was socially distanced. I get all that. I'm not talking about the risk at this point. Now I'm talking about the statement, the image. It would have crystallized where we are today and where we want to get tomorrow without a mask. So maybe, and with today's technology, I think they could have put some kind of a microphone somewhere that even if he had a mask, it would have sounded good. And maybe if it sounded a little muffled, all the better. It would have showed that, yes, during these times, we need to adapt, we need to sacrifice, and we need to accept that we can't have things the way we're used to, which makes us hopefully want to get to those times quicker to do so. Do what we should do so we can get back to those times. It would have been an amazing image to see Bruce Springsteen on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on inauguration night singing Land of Hope and Dreams with a mask on. And he didn't do it. He missed a huge opportunity. We would still be talking about that today. It would be on the cover of every magazine. It would have been the photo for not only today, but 20 years from now when we're talking about this pandemic, they would have shown that picture. This is what reality was for a while. Even you know, public performances were affected by this. So you had a chance to make history, Bruce. You really did. But anyway. But yeah, so there we are. Here we are in February, and we'll see where things are going. We've got talks of unity. So far, I guess, you know, everything is beautiful. You know, on Inauguration Day, wow, the rhetoric was really flying. Everybody was talking about this great exhale. Okay, that's fine. I understand that. But, I don't know if we have, you know, I don't know if it's possible to have a savior that's going to make, you know, suddenly it seemed, they thought on January 20th, everybody thought that everything in the world was going to be just get better all of a sudden. I understand the optimism. But, you know, you have to also face reality if you really want to get some stuff done. You can't just have pie-in-the-sky dreams. So we'll see how things go. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I want any president to be successful. That's the way I look at it. Public, you know, political parties aside, I want any president, whether I agree with them or disagree with them, to be successful, because if a presidency is successful, that means the country has been successful, and that means I'm a part of that success. So, you know, that's what was so disheartening over the last 4 years. There was such division, and there was such deep hate and almost vulgar rhetoric that people were forgetting is that if the president doesn't do well, we don't do well. And so for the last 4 years, there was a climate where if we didn't do well as a country, don't just blame the president for that. We contributed to that too. A lot of people contributed to that on both sides. And it's the same way now with the new administration. So okay, now we're going to, now let's see what happens with this. But I root for any president, regardless of political affiliation or ideology, whether I agree with them or not. I haven't always agreed with the president. I haven't always voted for the person who got elected. But whoever won, I always rooted for them, hoped that they would succeed. That's what we need to get back to. Forget about political ideologies. We need to succeed as a country, and that means our president does, whoever he or she is, and whoever and whatever agendas they may have. President Trump, President Biden, President Obama, President Bush, whoever. I didn't like or agree with every one of them, but I supported them all as my president, because they were in charge. And how they did, we did. So we'll see what happens. So this, in the last week or so, we've also had some many high-profile passings of some people that I wanted to touch upon. Baseball great Henry Aaron passed away at age 86. Now, this is, interestingly enough, this is podcast number 245. So I wouldn't have known. He hadn't passed away when I did it. But so we're close enough, though. It would have been, talk about symmetry. We're just one away. But this is episode 245. Hank Aaron was number 44. So we were almost close. But I couldn't have talked about him in my last podcast because at that point he hadn't passed away. Timing is everything, which I will get to. In another little discussion here, but Hank Aaron, this is a guy. Sports, once again, I don't want to get too into sports. I know some people aren't into sports, and that's fine. But I think many times we can also look at some of the sports figures and also talk about them in a larger sense. And certainly, Hank Aaron falls into that category. Not only was he an accomplished baseball player, Hall of Famer, broke many, many records, still holds many, many records, some that probably will never be touched. He was a very steady, one of baseball's greatest players, and he's got the stats to prove it. Wasn't the most flashiest player, went about his business. Even his stats, he didn't hit 400. He didn't hit 65 home runs a year. He never had these amazing breakout seasons, but he had consistently excellent seasons over a long period of time. And that's the way he broke so many records, including, at the time, in 1974, the most coveted of all baseball records, Babe Ruth's home run record. A lot of people were surprised and disappointed that it was Hank Aaron who was going to break this record. And there were many aspects to it. One of the disappointments, in quotes, that it was Hank Aaron was that he wasn't the flashy player. He wasn't the player that commanded, media attention. He wasn't a hot dog. He didn't accomplish these major once-in-a-lifetime feats like 65 home runs or 61 home runs in a season or hitting 400 like Ted Williams or, as I said before, hitting 61 home runs by Roger Maris. He just went about his business and put up amazing statistics reliably year after year after year. So he broke Babe Ruth's record by sticking around longer and just and doing it in a steady career that was year upon year, reliable, steady, and excellent. Maybe not the highest peaks, but high enough that over time, I think a 23-year career, he not only broke Babe Ruth's record, but he went way past it, 755 home runs. And that record was only beaten by Barry Bonds. And there's, a lot of controversy about how he did that with possible steroid use. There was a lot of people that thought that Willie Mays, a much more charismatic, dynamic player, made some amazing catches, ran through, one of the best athletes, maybe the best person ever to play the game. But even Willie wound up with 660 homers. Close, but not really close to Babe's 714. Willie had some amazing seasons, but Hank had a steady number of great seasons. Most people had amazing, great, better seasons than Hank did every year. But there was Hank with his 40 home runs and his 100 and some RBIs. And for a home run hitter and an RBI guy like Hank Aaron to have hit and have a 305 batting average for a career, once again, it speaks to his great ability. But he wasn't the flashiest player, so a lot of people were kind of disappointed. They wanted Willie Mays, and they wanted some other high-profile, charismatic person to break the record. And here was quiet Hank, who just went about his business, putting up impressive stats every year, and basically he broke Babe Ruth's record, by supporting the old adage that it's the tortoise and not the hare. He went at it at the tortoise's strategy. Took his time. Over the long haul, he won. The hare might have run faster in the race, but he also petered out. And the tortoise kept the same pace, a good pace, but a steady pace, and at the end of the day, beat the hare. And that's the way Hank Aaron went about breaking Babe Ruth's record. He didn't do it in the hare way. He did it in the tortoise way. And it doesn't matter how it's done. The numbers speak for themselves. But certainly, more than just about what kind of player Hank Aaron was. Back in 1974, this country, and we look at, I mean, once again, how have we really moved all that much in 40 years? Here we are today with still huge racial divisions, Black Lives Matters movements, systemic and racial inequality. That's all we're talking about today. Now, if you go back 40 years, that's what was in place back then. And so it was not a very popular thing. You know, Babe Ruth's 714 home run record had been around for decades. People grew up, if you were a baseball fan, you just grew up knowing that number. And most people never even saw Babe Ruth play, but they knew who Babe Ruth was. He was this bigger-than-life figure, and it was only, you know, he set so many records when he played. He was so far and away the best hitter of his time and his generation that he became a legend and elevated to folklore kind of status. And so the thought of anybody even challenging Babe Ruth's records was almost an affront, almost un-American. And Roger Maris broke Babe Ruth's record in the 60s for most home runs in one season with 61. Babe had the record for 60. But once again, Roger Maris, a good player, not a great player, wasn't one of the, he was a good player of his time, but he wasn't a flashy guy. Once again, just kind of a meat and potatoes, nuts and bolts guy who just got it done. He took the tortoise approach again and broke Babe Ruth's record. And while it was a big deal, Babe still had the career home run record. And so people then clung to that after his 60 home runs in a season was broken. So this was a big deal. This was a record that most people, especially baseball fans, grew up knowing and respecting, and it took on this folklore, legendary, image for many baseball fans. And then along comes Hank Aaron, who slowly but surely, while nobody's really paying attention to Hank Aaron, while they're all, being electrified by some of the great players that came up during the same time Hank played, like Stan Musial and Mickey Mantle, and people like this and Willie Mays, while they were being dazzled by those kind of players, meanwhile, here was Hank just getting it done. And as his career reached the 20-year standing, well, that consistency was paying off in terms of amazing statistics that he was just quietly piling up, while a lot of hares were having amazing single or couple of seasons where they were dazzling people and breaking records maybe, or just creating an amazing buzz. There was Hank, slowly and quietly hitting his 30 to 40 homers a year, and slowly and quietly driving in his 100 runs a year, and slowly and quietly hitting, in the upper 290s and 300s. So by the time it came to 1974, someone turned around in like 1972 and said, Hank Aaron's got like, 600 and some home runs here. He has a chance to break this record. He's getting older now. Can he do it? Well, once again, Hank just kept up that same high level of excellence. Didn't blow anybody away with his stats, but had impressive enough stats over a long period of time for those to just keep adding up. And as I said before, it was not a very popular premise or notion that if somebody was going to break this record back in 1974, yes, we've had civil rights movements in the 60s and there was more integration and affirmative action, but race
as it's always been in this country, was still a volatile topic. And sadly, Hank Aaron faced enormous racial prejudice for even coming at before he broke it, for even threatening or coming close to breaking Babe Ruth's hallowed home run record of 714. And apparently the hate mail and the hate that was thrown at Hank Aaron for at least a year and a half or two when he started to get close to the 714 number was, I've heard and seen on television and documentaries some of the hate mail that he got, and some of the language and the sentiments were so brutal and so angry and so hateful and so despicable that you wouldn't even believe it. And it was under those circumstances and from a mental standpoint that not only was he a great player and did he only not only break the record, but you would have thought that under this kind of pressure that we didn't see when he took the field, but he certainly had in his mind and on his shoulders of this prejudice and racial hatred that was aimed at him for even having the audacity of being a black man who would even think of breaking a white man Babe Ruth's record. That was the mindset of many of these people. And don't forget, Hank Aaron was also playing in Atlanta, Georgia, right? You know, if you ever saw Gone with the Wind, you know, Atlanta plays a pretty big role in the Civil War. So that's the Deep South, right? That's the heart of the Deep South. So in the heart of the Deep South, and that's back then in the 70s, to fly a Confederate flag, that was no big deal at all. That was commonplace. So in the seat of the Deep South, of the home of the Confederacy in many ways, here was a black man who was going to break a respected and hallowed record by a white man in the and at that time in the 70s, still considered the national sport, the national pastime, baseball. So wow, there were a lot of factors going on in that. Now, as a little kid, I had no idea of all the subtext that was going on during that. All I know is that in my lifetime, suddenly that this record, which I just heard about, right? I think I was 12, 13 or so, 11. When it started, when the talk of breaking Babe Ruth's record, I didn't, you know, once again, growing up, you start to hear this stuff, but suddenly that 714 number became a number that you knew without even, if you said 714, you automatically thought of Babe Ruth's home run record. That's how, especially in the 70s, as you know, Hank Aaron was getting close to it, it was just 714 mania. That number you just knew about what it referred to. You didn't have to say anything. You say 714, you know it's Babe Ruth's home run record. So there were so many layers of context and subtext around this. As a kid, I wasn't aware of racism like that or all these societal pressures or the history of all that. I was just watching this guy named Hank Aaron run after a record of a guy named Babe Ruth who I'd only seen pictures of too. All I know is I saw Hank Aaron. I was lucky enough to see Hank Aaron play in person. At Wrigley Field, being a Cub fan, I saw Hank Aaron play a few times. So that was pretty cool. I think I may even see him hit a home run. It's hard for me to remember now. But I went to a lot of Cub games when I was a kid in the 70s. So I do remember going to see Hank Aaron. That I do remember. But I was still relatively young. But I do remember where I was. It's one of those kind of things. Where were you? And I do remember where I was, like everyone else, watching television. I believe it was a Monday night game, or they just televised this game because, ironically, he finished the 1973 season tying Babe Ruth's record. So he had to go the whole winter waiting to hit one more home run.
And so finally, early in the season, in Atlanta, the stage was set. They were playing the Los Angeles Dodgers. And, I mean, I don't know. There was a pitcher named Al Downing. He was a good pitcher for the time. I don't know. I mean, when you look at the home run, the 715th home run, I think I could have hit that. I think my wife could have hit that out as a home run, okay, because that was a beach ball. I mean, Al Downing gave him a pitch right in his wheelhouse, a nice high fastball right there, and Hank did what he should have done with it. So I don't know if Al fed him that pitch or not. At the end of the day, you know what? Al Downing went down in history. I would not know Al Downing's name or even care about Al Downing's name, but if you talk to me about the 715th home run, I immediately think of Al Downing. So Al Downing put himself in a piece of history. So maybe for the time being, within that game or within that thing, he hit it off of Al Downing. That was supposedly a bad thing, right? You didn't want to be the pitcher that gave up the 715th home run, but maybe you do. Because I, you know, 50 years later, I remember Al Downing. And it wasn't a tremendous cloud. It got over the fence pretty well. Bill Buckner of the Dodgers tried to climb the fence. Probably wanted to get the ball. Little trivia question. There was a relief pitcher for the Atlanta Braves at the time named Tom House. And Tom House is the one, because he was out there in the bullpen where the ball bounced and went over the fence. That's where the bullpen was in Atlanta. And so Tom House was the guy who didn't catch it when it flew, but he got it and, of course, gave it back to Hank Aaron. But it was Tom House. So there's your – Al Downing gave up the pitch to Hank Aaron, and Tom House was the one who retrieved the ball. So a little trivia for you. But while Hank Aaron went about his business in a very elegant, classy, with quiet dignity, we did not hear a lot about the hate mail and the threats, the death threats that he was getting. That was kind of pushed out of the story because they didn't want to bring in that social aspect. But now in history, over the last 50 years since that, and racial relations and some of the hypocrisies of our racial divide here have come to light. We have seen more and we've talked about more about some of the aspects of this. And Hank Aaron's home run record and home run chase falls into the same category as many of the other racial movements and racial moments and racial divides of this country. It sadly reared its head during Hank Aaron's home run chase of Babe Ruth's record, but it was there and it was real. Hank did not talk about it publicly. He was not that kind of person. He did not make a big issue about it. But what was telling was when he was interviewed after he hit it right on the field, they brought a microphone out while everybody was on the field and everybody celebrating, and he said, "I'm glad it's over." And at the time, I remember as a 12-year-old kid being kind of taken aback, like, well, that's an odd thing to say. Why would you be glad it's over? Shouldn't you be excited? But in the years after that, we realized why Hank was happy it was over. Because to the outside world, there was a lot of excitement about this breaking of the record and a lot of talk about it. But behind the scenes, there was a lot of hatred and racism and division and the ugly side of our national discussion behind our national pastime. And a lot of that was not talked about. And yet Hank Aaron not only withstood all the hatred, all the prejudice, all the racism personally, but professionally, he continued to do what he always did. Perform at a high level. And yes, he not only broke the record, he shattered the record by 40 home runs when he retired. And even though Barry Bonds is the official holder of the home run record, there's always an asterisk around it because of his of the rumors of him taking steroids. And so many baseball purists will still look and say, it's still Hank, the hammer. And so we should certainly remember and recognize and be in awe of not just the fireworks on Inauguration Day, but on the accomplishments of Hank Aaron. Not a flashy guy, not always the best player, but one damn good player for a long period of time who wound up really being the home run king and proving that old adage, it's not the hare who wins the race, it's the tortoise. Nice job, Hank. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com, or we can be found wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. And don't forget, tell your friends, tell your family, send them a link, send them a message. Let them know that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion and that little extra effort is much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 245. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of the web to your screen. Go get him, Hammer.